When we say we want to change the future of women's well-being, it is not a tagline. It's a mission statement. It's a mantra. It can't just be in the conversations that we're having just with the OBGYNs and doulas or just on one specific product. Like, it is literally it seeps into every single thing we do.
Welcome back to Her CEO Journey. You are tuning in for our podcast series, Investing in Employees. We know people are the most significant asset in any business, and employees are the gold for any business. But if we don't have a strategy, processes, and programs in place, and intentionally treat employee as the gold of a company, we can talk about how much we care that people come first. Still, in the end, people will leave and find another company, or they will stay, but they become disengaged. If you haven't listened to the first episode in this podcast series, find episode 180, where we spoke with Lisa Hannum, the founder and CEO of Beehive, a certified B Corporation. You will learn the strategy and investment Beehive has to ensure its full-time and fractional team members are taken care of. You're listening to Her CEO Journey, the business finance podcast for mission-driven women entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Christina Shahli. If you are new here, a big warm welcome. If we are not connected on LinkedIn, please reach out and say hi, because that's where I hang out and share my business finance tips. If you have been listening to this podcast for a while and you are a regular listener, I want you to know I appreciate you. My podcast won't be around without your support. This is a free weekly show where my guests and I want to inspire you to balance between mission and profit, to create an impact in this world, and to achieve financial equality through your business for good. In the second episode of this podcast series, we speak with Eden Lauren, the CEO and co-founder of Nisa Care. Nisa creates effective products, real and honest conversation about all aspects of women's transformative times of life, from postpartum recovery, period comfort, to body awareness. What prompted us from Her CEO Journey team to reach out to Eden was the bold move made by the founding members to let go their male legal and accounting team, not because of their skills. So why did the founding members made this bold decision? And what is the foundation they built to invest in their employees? Let's find out Eden's CEO journey. Eden Lauren, welcome to Her CEO Journey. It is a pleasure to have you here today.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So Eden, like I said earlier, I was reading your bio. You started a school in Guatemala. You studied and speak Italian and Spanish, and then you won a championship in volleyball. And right now, you are basically working to change the future of women well-being forever. It is a real journey. How did you evolve from starting a school in Guatemala to become the CEO and co-founder of Nisa?
Not a linear story, right? those are all very different.
Yeah.
I played volleyball leading up to college and then in college. So I played Division I at DePaul. And it taught me a tremendous amount of work ethic, that's for sure, and how to work really hard. But I think it was not until I got into college that I started to see outside of my own network or see other cultures. My mother's Italian, so I'd always been exposed there. But I guess really the underserved or those that have been marginalized. And that's what led me to go to Guatemala after graduating. I was by myself and I stayed with a group of students that were studying elsewhere. So it was a kind of a journey for myself on understanding how I can learn and be a part of a community, but also know that I do leave at a certain point. There's an end date. And so how do you create a solution or identify a problem, if you will? And even that comes from a pretty privileged state of mind, right? And how do I give for this certain amount of time and not create a void or create something that's not sustainable after I return to the States? And I didn't speak Spanish. And so I was told kind of going into this, the circumstances that the community spoke English, and then they were all told that I spoke Spanish, which is not fair. And so when I arrived, you know, I'm a fast talking Chicagoan and was like, hey, how's everyone doing? And everyone thought I was just wild. And so I had to learn Spanish very quickly. The group that was the easiest to talk to were children. The children were very patient with me. So I said, okay, instead, why don't I start a program for you guys? Because none of them could afford to go to school. They didn't have books and they didn't have uniforms. That there was school wasn't even an option. So I found a shed. I built a school out of it. It was not certified. So they didn't get actual diplomas. It was just teaching that we created. And then I found a bunch of stateside school programs that could donate product or could create a kind of a sustainable model where they every year would be able to continue to send school supplies and lesson plans. It's still going.
Really? Until now?
Yeah, until now. But really what it did was it created a foundation for me and understanding, okay, here's what I'm trying to do. These are the pieces you need, whether like flash forward to now, whether it's working capital or supplies or vendors, but like just figuring out kind of that ecosystem to get a program going. And it was a very tiny, tiny example of it, but it really, I kind of caught the bug, if you will. And then I came back and I worked a nonprofit and I just happened to stumble into the food and beverage scene. And a friend of mine asked me to cover for her for a shift. I'd never worked in food and beverage. I'd never worked at a restaurant. I said, sure. It happened to be a cocktail program in Chicago that was very young at the time, but it was leading. This was the cocktail scene had just begun in the States. It was this movement to elevate and be really thoughtful about ingredients and where you're sourcing them. And I started in this space and I thought, well, this is cool. This is fun. This is a good way to make some money. But I looked around and everyone who was creating this very elevated drink and being very culinary, they were all men. We were reading these books. It was very much studying pre-prohibition and cocktails, and they're all written by men. And then I look at these other locations and they're men. And I was like, well, hold up. I want to do this. I want to be back there doing this. I just kept going. So I became the manager and the GM, and then all the partners that owned the spot were men. And I said, I want to be partner. And so I'm partner. And then I wanted us to win an award and we won a James Beard.
Yeah, from a school to food and beverages and then, you know, becoming quote unquote bartender, but an experienced one. And then what happened with Nisa? When did you start?
I will say in the food and beverage scene, I saw some other holes. I saw that, again, there weren't women in this space. So on the side, I had started a catering company called She, S-H-E, and it was women-led. And we would create cocktails or product development for different brands and different events. Eventually, I had a partner in that. It was a great friend. And she had a child. Then 6 months later, I had my first child. Just like many industries, there's not a lot of support for like parental leave. I went to my business partner in the consulting business and I said, man, you had a child 6 months ago. Like, how come you didn't tell me? She was like, I didn't realize that I should, that I could. She was so surprised by everything that happened. She was so surprised by the postpartum experience and not having the information or the products. And we realized there's something here. So we started to talk to other women and it was an absolute universal truth. It was from people who had had children recently to those that had adult children. It was the same thing. We realized that nothing had really improved. We didn't see that we were getting more information from our doctors. We were definitely not seeing products in stores that were any better than what people were receiving 40, 50 years ago. That really led us, especially because we were so driven around product development. Again, here's a problem. How can we think thoughtfully? Is there a space in which to solve this? And I just happened to have one of my best friends, she was pregnant and she worked in brand strategy and brand design. And when we confronted her with this and we said, we don't want to tell you everything because you're about to have a child. And she was like, no, we have this, that's the opposite. We need to know everything. Like, stop. And so we're like, oh, you're right. You're right. But she really called something out immediately where my head was around the products. What do we need for our bodies? What do we need for healing? She really called out, now we have centuries of women suffering through, of women being told, don't talk about it, don't share the message. And so it is not just a product issue. It's also a language issue. She, right from the beginning, said, I want to be part of this. And I want to think about it as two pillars. And that is design and innovation and products, but also language and content and resources, because they have to go hand in hand. And that's where Nisa started.
Nisa started during the pandemic, which is 2020. Did you do like a lot of research to understand what are this unmentionable or things that we as women are not supposed to talk about?
If anyone who's looking to start a business is listening, I'm going to say something that people said to me a lot and I rolled my eyes at, but I'm going to tell you it's the truth. Everything takes longer. Plan for longer. You'll do better if you cushion yourself with more time, because more preparation is highly recommended. It's going to be needed. But I will say, so I had my son in 2017, maybe middle of the year. It took me several months to not only navigate my postpartum experience, but to really understand how to funnel my disappointment and my anger. And I will say that it started the hour after he came out, when I was handed the mesh underwear, if you can call it that, one size fits all. You have to cut it if you have had a cesarean delivery, or you try to improvise if you've had vaginal. And then I gave birth at a gorgeous hospital, but they gave me like the ice pack that you use in a cooler, like the hard plastic ice pack. So, I mean, right away, I was like, wait, what's up? What's going on here? This isn't right. It took several months to really put together what is it that we can do here. If no one's done it, why haven't they done it? We did a lot of focus groups with women, friends, family, and then outside of that, brought women together, sometimes just sending them questions. And then also talking to medical professionals. And that was fascinating because it was almost the same questions. Like, why isn't this better? Like, why, when I look at the design of this mesh, for instance, I see it hasn't changed. I can see the original models. I can see the original IP and pictures and drawings of it. And that's 70 years ago and it looks exactly the same. Like, why hasn't it changed? And universally, medical professionals would say, yes, I know. Like, yes, can you fix that? Then we started design. And we took a full year to design our first product. And that was the fourth wear underwear. And that was, I would say that's identifying people to help us with textiles, and it being functional was huge, getting the design right, and then establishing IP. So we have two patents on our fourth wear underwear, and then getting the pieces of the business together. How do you market it? How do you talk about it? How do you take photos of it? All of that. So it technically entered the market end of September 2019, but mostly to friends and family, like just soft kind of getting going. And then it really launched 2020.
It didn't scare you? That the fact that 2020 was the pandemic?
In retrospect, it very wild to have not only that, but we launched 5 products in 2020. So we had had majority of them in the works. And there were international manufacturers that were telling us in January, they said, something's happening. And we're like, what do you mean?
They knew like something is happening.
Yeah, because for instance, we had a manufacturer that we were working with one part of packaging that was in China. And they said, factories are told that we're like, we're going to be working less. These were folks that we'd been talking with and designing with. So we had a really good relationship. And it was almost on like a friend level. And we got a couple of messages and some conversations we were talking by phone in January. So like we started to know January, February leading into it, but had absolutely no idea of the scale. And I laugh about it because we were attempting to fundraise. We had kicked off our first, like our pre-seed round in March. We had made all these meetings and we were meeting with all these folks in March. And even as a team had flown a couple of places, which when you think about it now, never would have happened. It would have been a virtual conversation, but we had no money and we were gone some places to meet some potential investors. And then had a couple of sit downs. And then it was like the third week of March or the second week of March. And it was just everything shut down. And so obviously like we punted our round, but it was just so wild when you think about it now.
How did you deal with it? Like the pandemic gotta make you think and change your strategy.
I would say one advantage, if I could call it an advantage, is that we never had time to implement our pre-pandemic strategy. We have learned to pivot and react and adjust and be flexible since the beginning. We've only known how to try to operate leanly. We've only known challenges with supply chain. So we have 11 products now. It has created a system in which we have to have really strong relationships with our contract manufacturers that we're almost like kind of co-invested in success, right? Every product has, all except maybe two, have backups. And right now we're working on backups of the backups, because we're looking to scale in a big way in the next months. I think the most difficult thing has been capital. So fundraising turned off for folks, for institutional funders. And that makes it really hard when you're a startup, because then when you do go to fundraise, then the classic system there, the classic playbook, it doesn't really apply. And then folks are saying, well, how come you aren't at a million in sales? And you're like, well, because, you know, we're only using every dollar that we have. Or like, you know, how come you only are putting this much towards marketing? You're like, well, because I have to have a budget, because it's this strange, every part of the ground was shifting at the same time. Or retail. Retail had to adjust how many times in the last 2 years? You know, everybody was shopping online and then they were shopping back at stores. When we started, all these investors that we went to in 2020 said, retail is dead. No one's going to shop at a store. No one is going to go. Now it's like retail is be in mass retail and mass drug is where you buy your products. And that's in such a short amount of time that those trends have shifted.
One of your key strategy in starting a business in the middle of a pandemic and try to scale it is diversification, right? I heard you talk about that a lot, about diversifying your product.
Every product that we release has to, I use the word metrics, but it has to solve to an unmentionable. And that's first and foremost. So things that a woman needs from puberty to beyond menopause. We launched in postpartum. We had that focus in postpartum. And I will say our kind of legacy portfolio continues to be in postpartum. And that's, we've had the longest and strongest conversation, I'd say, with that part of our community. And so it's easy to continue to grow in there. When we start to release products that then transition out of postpartum, we have to be as a business very, very strategic. And I will say diversification, knowing that you want to, in our case, travel with a woman maybe as they start to get their period again, or if they've never been through a fourth trimester, which is great. So they're dealing with endometriosis and period pain and surgery, all things that we as a team have dealt with and our friends and family have dealt with. And that's really, I would say most of the products come from a personal place first. And then we run it through our other, is this other people experiencing these too? Other people had fibroids. How can we solve or create a product that supports someone who's going through having fibroids, for instance? And then we go to our medical professionals and we ask them, what is it that you're recommending? What this is what we're thinking about. And we strategize.
One of the reasons that I was so interested to speak with you, because I read on an article that the founding member of NISA basically decided to drop the male legal and accounting team, not because of their skills, but because of something else. So explain a little bit, why did you make this decision? What was the challenges you faced with them that led you to this decision to drop male legal and accounting team?
Any males that are listening, it is, we absolutely respect your brain, your wisdom, your acumen. I would say it's twofold. And one is when I, early on in the conversation, we're talking about kind of my career and development, that desire to be in spaces in which my gender has prohibited me. I think it continues even with those that I partner with. I have incredible male partners, again, in that cocktail space. But from that point on, I've only had female partners. Like, for instance, two of our vendors for our apparel are women-led co-manufacturers. I have no idea their business. They might be off the charts on how many customers that they work with. I have never asked them that. But my thought is, why wouldn't I partner and create an additional platform or make another space or give them an opportunity that I can only imagine they may not have, they have to struggle just as I have in other industries that I've worked in. So like, why wouldn't I? So that generally leads in just looking for manufacturers. But then I think it goes back to that shared empathy with legal representation. When we're talking about defense of IP, when we're talking about goals and expansion of the brand, it's a lot easier to understand what we're trying to do when you've had a similar experience. And I think that tends to work well with female-led programs. And it probably seems like a weak argument when it comes to accounting. But you know what? When I say that's a postpartum underwear, I can usually just say that in one phrase and that's it. And when I say that's the period care line, we get it. We're speaking the same language. And then when I say, let's make the category for like our perimenopause, like that's it. We understand. It makes things easier to pivot and easier, I think, to communicate.
I completely agree. And then I have the same passion. And I can relate completely with your experience in the food and beverage industry. My own experience came from mining. And mining is huge with male-dominated leaders. When I was pregnant with my son, and here in Canada, we got 12 months back then of maternity leave.
Wow.
Even though the rule and the legislation or the legal rule saying that I can stay 12 months, there is pressure from my job. And then I was being questioned. Well, and then this is so classic. The CEO of the company basically asked, why did you have to stay for 12 months when my wife was pregnant and delivered? It took her only like a few weeks to go up and running. So why did you need 12 months? Like, that's ridiculous. I feel you. And then I understand completely the culture that you are trying to build.
Absolutely. And I also think that it's when we say we want to change the future of women's well-being, it is not a tagline. it's a mission statement. It's a mantra. It can't just be in the conversations that we're having just with the OBGYNs and doulas or just on one specific product. Like it is literally it seeps into every single thing we do, from how we hold an internal meeting. If somebody has to go because their child is sick or needs something, there is never a question. There is never a pause. Like it is 100% understood that you could walk and go deal with what you have to do. It does not mean professionality has never skipped a beat. And we have a international, like we've always been virtual because of the pandemic. So we have team members that one of our co-founders is in the UK. So we always block the time when we're putting the children down to sleep, just understood. And that's what we do. To really be your truth, it has to be in every part of what you do, how we communicate in the work that we do, in our internal relationships, but then also in who we partner with. And that's really important. And it really does affect and create pauses when we think about like potential people that we will make a product with or a store that we'll launch in. Like, are they representing these values? Are they supportive or really fall into that system that we want to create? Because I think you're totally right in that. Now these are we're using examples of completely different industries, right?
It's the same. It's the same issue.
Like no one's going to change it for us. That became obvious. And that literally was why we started NISA.
If you're not in it, if you're not experiencing it, in my opinion, right? Like if it's different. It's a longer conversation to explain. It's a longer conversation to make them understand. You felt like you put in the energy for something that should not be explained because you should just get it. You should just get it when I said that I need 12 months of maternity leave because my child needs me. I'm assuming now majority of your team members are women?
We're 100% female owned and operated down to the fulfillment team. We own our fulfillment operations. We have male friends and partners and people that we've worked with. But when you are looking to fill a position and we're looking to think about what the skills are that someone might be adding to the team or be owning, I think that it's really hard if you're looking at two resumes, for instance, and you have someone who has gone through these experiences and really identifies with the mission of NISA in a passionate way. It generally will outshine someone who, like you said, does not necessarily get it. And it by no means ever have I held it against someone who doesn't get it. Multiple members of our team haven't had children. So that's not the postpartum experience isn't something you have to get. It's just understanding the challenges of being a woman or identifying as a woman. And I think that it speaks volumes. And then it also makes it so that someone coming in and is going to help create content for us. Well, they don't need to be told on what content they're creating, because they've read our blog and said, yes, I had that same experience. And so I'm going to write about that. It's just very different for someone who hasn't had that shared life experience. And it makes them more qualified. It makes someone who understands what we're doing more qualified.
What are the strategy for you as the CEO to build the culture and the team that you want? So they can come to a place where they talk, they listen, and they share stories?
Great question. I'd say it's lovely to have like the organization and the model that we're creating is important. I want to just call this out because I think it's an important challenge that people face anyway. It's one thing to have it when you're a really small team and you're starting and you can have the vision, but the next is scaling that. And you start to bring other folks on, or you start to work with agencies, for instance. It's thinking about it, like you asked, like what does that future look like? And I would say There's nowhere that we have the anticipation or the expectation that someone has to give their full truth every moment of the day. Like no one has to say like, oh, my period pain or my, you know, like there's no expectation that you have to give that. But the culture is that we have very open and empathetic communication. If a team member is dealing with something, there is 100% that they know there is the support that they can talk about it either one-on-one or as a team. They can bring that to a meeting for sure. That our personal experiences are very much a part of the conversation that we're building outside of, I was going to say these walls, but it doesn't work virtually, outside of just within the brand. And I think a good example of that is co-founder Mia. And so she leads on all our content and branding. She had an incredibly challenging year and wrote about a miscarriage that she had. Her background is she wrote for The Guardian for years. She's a journalist background, is a beautiful, gorgeous voice. She wrote about this experience and it was in the Washington Post. I think when that first came out, I of course shared it to my friends and family. The amount of feedback that I received from people that I didn't even know had had a miscarriage. And as a team, we set aside time and we talked about it. Like, was this, there were team members that it was to read it, they felt at the same time almost triggered because they had had miscarriages that they hadn't talked about and hadn't processed and had packed away for years. And when reading that voice, that is the voice of the, you know, your friend or your coworker or your person that you see every day, and you read that and you hear the truth of her experience, and then it reminds you of your experience, it opened some floodgates really and saved the space to be like, well, do you want to talk about it? Like this has happened. And we had a meeting and there were two members that started crying because they were moved by the story, but they were moved by the fact that they were part of an environment that brought that story out publicly in a publication like the Washington Post. And that was really impactful. And to me, that told me that what we were trying to build as a culture 2 years ago, we're continuing to sustain. And that's really important. And I think that keeping that as a through line, it's really imperative. And that means it is whether you're saving space, whether it's part of how you check in with your team, also how you support if someone has to take leave, having wellness days, things like that. Or at least this year, we had decided to hold time that everyone had to step away from work and they had to not take meetings or calls and we didn't schedule anything. And we had to reflect on the work that we're doing and how does it tie to our broader mission. And we are a for-profit, but we don't want to get caught up in sales numbers and margins. And we want to make sure that what we're doing is life-giving to us and that we feel good and we have that balance and that we're executing in a way that we feel confident and strong.
The fact that you made a decision to drop your counterpart in legal and accounting team that are male, would you make the same decision today?
Yes. I would say that we'll continue to prioritize when we can either female-led programs or females that lead with us within someone's department or firm. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be a home run with the partners that you do set up. There's still personality and performance and all kinds of things that come into play. That's really imperative to recognize that I don't think just because you find efficiencies in one side that it necessarily means it's going to be success. And you have to keep open eyes on that. And like how you gauge success has to be still for the success of the business, if that makes sense, not just mission oriented. Even as we've continued to grow and add other agencies or vendors or other firms that we work with, it is thinking about that there is a lead that is familiar with what we're working towards. And that is female or identifies as female. You know, what's really fascinating in one area that we haven't talked about with that investment And I find that really interesting. We do have, I guess, a majority of our investors are women, but we do have male investors. That has been really interesting to me, thinking about that shared empathy. There are investors or groups that are male-led that are very focused on wanting to, and most of them tend to be that they have had partners or family members in their life that have either like suffered through or are working through areas in which NISA is touching. And so that feeling, that passion towards anything from perimenopause or cysts or complicated delivery or something, that it is really drives either their, not usually their portfolio, but more their desire to participate with NISA.
I think because of their experience, they have the empathy.
Exactly. Yeah, so exactly. It's interesting because you, again, don't necessarily need to identify as female to have that empathy, but especially when it comes to investment, I see it more.
And I completely agree. And then I'm glad you shared that, because going back to our earlier conversation, we're not saying that all male do not understand this space, but unless you have the empathy and then you still relate it to some experience, then it's easier to explain what NISA is trying to accomplish, because it is very personal. Now, I'm curious, Eden, we talk about unmentionable a lot in this conversation. What was your unmentionable before you started NISA?
The reality of navigating a period, navigating a miscarriage, or understanding how to speak about cysts, fibroids, all of those, they were all unmentionables to me, because, and I come from a really open family. So by no means was that shrouded in like shame, but it was more that I didn't have a way to speak about it or know who and how to speak about it. I remember once getting a medical procedure for a Bartholin gland cyst, and I rode my bike because I was told, I don't know, just like show up at the appointment. And I didn't know that you would like bleed. So I had to walk my bike home, and I forgot to say this. I had white pants on, rode my bike. And I later, like years later, were writing a report or like writing a blog post or journal. And it was about cysts. And me and another co-founder had dealt with this exact type of cyst. It's extremely common. And I mentioned that story and I was like, I cannot believe that it's taken this many years to process that. No doctor told me what to expect. No doctor told me how to treat myself. And that I went in knowing so little that I would ride my bike to like a vaginal procedure. Those kinds of things. When I started NISA, I had no idea about the difference between a vagina and a vulva. I didn't know how to identify the parts of a vulva. I remember we had we did like this beta of a virtual class that we had some advisors that were OBGYN speaking about the parts of a vulva, and my mother was watching. At one point, she was in the same room with me, but we were both watching it virtually. And I checked in with her and she was like, I'm flabbergasted. And she was pretty emotional about it, because she was like, at this age, and I did not know these parts of my body. I think all of those were our unmentionables. And if I could add one more that's like outside the realm of how we define unmentionables, I will say in business leadership, it is the feeling of, I don't like saying imposter syndrome, but that feeling of continue to feel confident and strong, I think is an unmentionable. I hear it the most with women-led brands. Recently a male said this to me too, that he suffers this or feels this. So I just think it's just in general. I think we're often told that when you get to a position of leadership or you're creating a new business or you use the title of CEO, that you have to have all the answers all the time. And the truth is, vast majority don't. We think about the last couple of years in particular, everyone's adjusting. And whether you're running something like TikTok or you're running something that is just starting and doesn't have customers yet, like we're all adjusting. Everybody is learning it. And I don't think we mention that. I don't think we're allowed. There's not a space to show that weakness. There's not a space to ask questions. You can't go to an investor and say, I haven't figured that part out yet. No, you have to have the answer. I would say that's, I don't know what that word is. And I don't want to say imposter because I don't feel like an imposter, but that's my unmentionable.
A lot of people always say, and then I don't know where this culture came or how we came to this, fake it until you make it.
Yes. Yes. And we can see that. We see that with software companies that for years had crazy, insane valuations that now we're all like learning from and not able to get investment because that it rocked the economy. And because it was all fake it till you make it. We see it Theranos, fake it till you make it.
This has been such a great conversation with you, Eden. And now the last thing I'm going to ask you, where can people find you and where they can purchase Nisa's product?
Oh, yes. Thank you. So most directly on our website. So that's nisacare.com. We're on Facebook and Instagram, of course, but we also are on Substack, which I'd highly recommend, especially if folks like engaging with content or reading long form pieces. And that's called Body of Knowledge on Substack. And then we sell products at CVS nationally in the States, and then Pee in the Pod, Motherhood Maternity, some of our partners. We're on Amazon, but don't shop for us there. Hit up our website. And we're continuing to grow. So I would say there's continue to be more products all the time. Oh, and then our podcast, we have a podcast and that's on Spotify or anywhere that you listen to your podcast. And that's called The Unmentionables. Season 4 is about to drop.
Thank you so much, Eden. This has been a pleasure, truly, to speak about many things and then have this authentic conversation with you.
Thank you. Thank you. It's an awesome opportunity to talk to you and be part of your program. So thank you. And thanks for all the work you're doing.
And that brings us to the end of another episode. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Her CEO Journey, the business finance podcast for mission-driven women entrepreneurs. When you are ready to grow to the next level and seeking a finance team and a fractional CFO who are all in on your mission and can help you maximize profit to make a bigger social impact, connect with us at theprofitreimagine.com/let's chat.